It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to the creator of the FBI's active shooter program and get her thoughts on the police response to the recent mass shooting in a Texas school and how law enforcement should respond to active shooters. Now, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held its third public hearing today. Today's hearing focused on former Vice President Mike Pence, his responsibilities and limitations under the 12th Amendment, and pressure from former President Trump on Pence to unlawfully overturn the results of the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching or listening to the hearing today? What do you think? What questions do you have about what came out? What do you hope we still find out? Are there things that you think should be done when it comes to accountability for people involved in that, changes to laws in the future? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lily Gorin is professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today, Ron.
Before we get to today's hearing, Lily, could you highlight some of what you took away from the first two hearings leading up to this?
Well, again, the committee is kind of trying to lay out a sort of clear understanding not only of what transpired in the assault on the Capitol on January 6th, but also what led there in terms of, you know, how the people who came there were inspired to come there, what the plan may have been, who was involved in any planning, and also, you know, sort of discussions and understandings of what was going on in the Oval Office, in the White House, and conversation about, you know, what the election outcome was, how the president had been, you know, alerted and it had been explained to the president, and, you know, what his then sort of response to the presentation of those facts has been.
The focus today, again, on Vice President Pence and pressure from President Trump in particular to try to get him to claim unilaterally this power to ignore the electoral slates from different states. Lily, a lot of the drama, of course, was the violence, the assault in the Capitol. Supposing that hadn't happened and the crowd had stayed peaceful that day, how shocking would it be, though, to see a president trying to have a vice president claim this non-existent power and ignore the results of an election?
I think that would have remained quite shocking. I mean, I think it was made even more so by, obviously, the assault on the Capitol, the fact that, and if those who are watching the hearings today or listening to some of the testimony, we saw footage again of Vice President Pence and many of his staff and his family being escorted out of his office that's off the side of the Senate chamber. And so you have all of those things that did transpire under this umbrella of violence and attack, and people also advocating for hanging the vice president or killing the vice president. And even if none of that had happened, the advocacy to a vice president that he or she has the capacity to essentially invalidate the votes of any number of citizens in a variety of states because the president doesn't like the outcome is shocking.
I want to give a listen to one of the live witnesses today, former federal judge Michael Luttig, a conservative lawyer, a mentor to a lot of prominent figures in the conservative legal world and others. Here he is, and I think it's a quote that people will turn back to over time.
That declaration of Donald Trump as the next president would have plunged America into what I believe would have been tantamount to a revolution within a constitutional crisis.
Can you respond to that and the other testimony from former Judge Michael Luttig?
Well, what he is talking about is, you know, again, if the vice president had followed through on what he was being pressured to do, and there were two tracks that he was being advised he could take, he could either essentially suspend the counting of the Electoral College votes on January 6th and send the Electoral College votes back to the states to be reanalyzed, I guess, not the votes themselves, the Electoral College votes, but the votes in the states themselves and thus the slates of electors. That was one option. And the other one was to essentially invalidate the slates of electors, say that they were not valid electors. And both of those would be, as my reading of the Constitution, the 12th Amendment, the Electoral Count Act of 1887, and sort of longstanding norms and traditions in the United States, both of those would be extremely unconstitutional options. And so what Judge Luttig was talking about was, if the vice president had followed that path, then you would have had not only a constitutional crisis, because the constitutional structure would have been essentially undermined by this move, which isn't allowed in the Constitution, and you would have had significant violence in the street, likely, because there would be a response from the people who had voted against Donald Trump or voted for Joe Biden with regard to essentially trying to remove then the illegitimately sitting president. I think that's what Judge Luttig was talking about.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at today's hearing of the January 6th Select Committee, focusing on pressure on Vice President Pence to block electoral slates from a number of states, likely including Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a number of opinions on this topic. First of all, I don't think it was an insurrection because we have three branches of government and the riot was only attacking the legislative branch. The second point I want to make is Trump was president until January 20th. So on January 6th, he had a responsibility as the leader of the executive branch to make sure that the election was appropriate and fair. And there is fraud in the 2020 election. I think history will prove that because the Dominion voting machines have not been inspected and the algorithm.
Jeff, thanks for calling in. Lily, the previous bits of testimony really tackled this. Then Attorney General Bill Barr and so many others day by day refuting arguments about claims of fraud.
Yeah, I mean, and that's essentially where you end up on January 6th, is that the investigation, and I think the Trump campaign brought 60 or 62 different lawsuits with regard to this, and that the Electoral College voters voted in December, and those votes were certified by the state legislatures in those states. And then they were then communicated to the United States Congress, where according to the 12th Amendment, there is a joint session that is presided over by the vice president in his role as president of the Senate, and they're opened and counted.
And the concern was raised at the end, Lily, by Judge Luttig and some of the people on the panel, that this isn't about 2 years ago. There are still claims, as we just heard, about Dominion voting machines that some officials in New Mexico were saying, well, we can't certify an election because Dominion voting machines. These are still live issues that Judge Luttig was concerned could lead to a concerted effort, maybe a successful concerted effort to overturn an election in, say, 2024.
Yeah, and that was his those were his concluding remarks, and that he's also written those up with regard to the possibility that in a future election for president, if the outcome is one that doesn't comport with, say, Donald Trump, should he be running, and his supporters and allies, and these are Judge Luttig's words, that there would be a move in the states to overturn it through a lot of the different machinations that are possible with regard to different certifications of electoral college voting slates.
We're talking to Carroll University Professor of Political Science Lily Gorin, looking at today's public hearing by the House Select Committee investigating the insurrection on January 6th, 2021. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to what you're hearing? The evidence today, looking at the pressure on Vice President Pence to claim a power to stop electoral votes from being counted from a number of states. Do you think laws need to be changed? Do you worry about future elections? What do you want to see come out of all of this, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Lily Gorin from Carroll University. The House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held its latest public hearing today, looking at pressure from then-President Trump on then-Vice President Pence to overturn the 2020 election by either refusing to count some electoral votes or send it back to states. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Grafton. Bob, hi.
Hi, Professor, I may be mispronouncing this, but what do we do in the kind of world we're in now where so many people have cognitive dissonance, I'm probably mispronouncing that, where they believe basically, which isn't true, but they've convinced themselves that it's true. How do we handle that situation?
Bob, thanks for the call. Cognitive dissonance, I think Bob was referring to. But Bob, I think talking about claims of misinformation and claims about voter fraud.
Yeah. And again, I think this is one of the key sort of jobs of the committee and these hearings in particular is to set out the actual facts of what transpired. When you see the images of Mike Pence being escorted out of the Capitol with his family and all of his aides, and you hear from his counsel, as we did today, what it was like that that they escaped the mob by 40 feet, essentially, and that the mob was coming to hang him. That sort of the reality of what was going on in this assault on the Capitol is sort of made a lot more clear. And as some people have suggested, it wasn't just some tourists visiting in as sort of an aggressive way, shall we say.
Thanks for the call, Bob. We'll go to Anne now in La Crosse. Anne, hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for your guest. Just looking at what the hearings and the Senate committee that is running the hearings, I realize that they're trying to, get out as much of the truth as possible. I'm curious what your opinion is on what the results, what they're looking for in terms of the purpose and results of these hearings. Specifically, do you think that this will result in, or are they looking to press criminal charges against former President Trump?
And thanks for the call. And that's a big question. The committee itself can't do criminal charges. But Lily, what do you think the possible outcomes could be here?
Well, I mean, I think this was actually today's hearings were a little bit, as we would say, in the weeds, more so than the previous hearings. And you got into a very interesting kind of legal dispute between the two witnesses over sentences in the 12th Amendment. And part of that has to do with how the Electoral College actually works and functions. And since it's in the Constitution and hasn't been removed, we still need to follow it. And so I think a lot of what the committee is also doing is sort of setting out areas that need legislative fixes. And one of those areas probably is the Electoral Count Act of 1887, when it was initially passed. And it may need some revisions to clarify some of the processes that follow along from the 12th Amendment and Article 2 in terms of the process of electing the president and the vice president. So I think that's part of what the committee is doing, is trying to sort of say, this is actually, we need to write legislative reform in some of these areas to protect against something like this happening again. They're also, you know, sort of making public a lot of the information and the thousands of interviews and hours of depositions that they've done. And that now, and the Justice Department has been following along in its own way, you know, with regard to potentially civil or criminal charges against a variety of people. And I believe in the midst of the testimony today, the Justice Department has asked the committee to send over all of its interviews. So the Justice Department has its interviews. The committee, as you noted, Rob, can't bring criminal charges against the people. They can make recommendations or referrals if they want to. This has been sort of one of the points of some dispute, whether they will do that. And the Justice Department would be the place where you would see criminal charges or civil charges brought against individuals.
Thanks for that call, Anne, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University about today's public hearing of the January 6th committee, in the U.S. House. Back to your calls now. Ed is with us in Madison. Ed, hi.
Hi there. You know, I really don't have a question. I have more of a comment, and I know it can probably be, it's like a broken record, but for people to come forward and you have this firm belief that the election was fraudulent, and you keep throwing the Dominion card of the reason why, that this was a good reason to, and it was an insurrection, not just on one part of the our political process. As a person from the outside looking in Washington, I like to see what I'm hearing, but I don't know if this is going to move the dial closer to people maybe changing their mind, or how do you feel that this is actually maybe going to be in the big picture? I know there's so much coming out, and it's really opened my eyes wide open, not just seeing what was on television, which was shocking enough, but when you actually get to hear it to this moment, and then people have forgotten about it. It just is shocking, and I'm dumbfounded that people still keep fighting that narrative that our election process was fraudulent. Yes, I'm sure there could have been a small percentage of fraud because maybe someone tried to vote twice. Maybe someone tried to, you know, maybe registered in different states. We see it with our political governorship here in Wisconsin. Does someone actually live in Wisconsin, but they're trying to run for governor?
Ed, I got you. You gave us a lot to talk about there. Lily, do you think it's an interesting question? Apart from the legal aspects here, does the presentation of what happened leading up to January 6th and on the day, does it, as Ed wonders, change people's minds?
Well, I think that's part of what the committee is doing or trying to do. And I think that's one of the reasons why they had the first hearings during prime time on most of the major television networks, so that they actually have been constructing a narrative understanding of not only what happened on January 6th, but the process that led up to it. And that it wasn't sort of a spontaneous eruption of a couple bad apples. And so what you saw in the conversations today, in the discussions with the witnesses today, was that there was this sort of ongoing press on the vice president to essentially act in an unconstitutional manner. And when he didn't decide to do that, there was then a sort of advocacy that he wasn't a good person, he wasn't doing the right thing, and that, you know, that was problematic, and maybe people should do something about that. And so you had this sort of long explanation of this legal theory presented by John Eastman with regard to the power that the vice president had, which nobody else thinks that the vice president really has, to essentially negate the Electoral College votes as they are counting them.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, Courtney, pointing out the role of former Vice President Pence and his resistance to this pressure, his refusal to get in a car for fear that Secret Service agents would remove him from the Capitol. Can you talk a little bit about the pressure he was under and the role he played?
Well, he was asked quite a few times by President Trump and by John Eastman to sort of execute this plan. And as I said earlier, there were sort of two prongs, two ways that he was told he could execute this plan. And he consulted with a number of people, including Greg Jacob, who was testifying today, who was one of his counsels, with regard to the sort of legality, the constitutionality of all of these things. And he decided, essentially, he came to the conclusion that it was unconstitutional for him to do that. He consulted with former Vice President Dan Quayle. He consulted with Judge Luttig. He consulted with quite a few people. And he kept getting pressure from the White House. It called from President Trump on the day of January 6th, even, to do this. And he didn't do it. And again, you see the mob, the pictures of the mob, and the articulation of what some of the people who were at the Capitol who said, you know, we're coming for Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence, because he had, in fact, not done what the president had asked him to do, which was unconstitutional to do.
Lily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Lily Gorin is professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University. We talked to her today about the hearing of the bipartisan House committee this afternoon investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol and the events leading up to it. Coming up after the news, the creator of the FBI's Active Shooter Response Program talks to us about the recent school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, and how to improve police training for similar incidents and how to hopefully prevent them from happening in the first place. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, regret is usually looked at as a negative emotion, but our guest says there's a lot we can learn from it. He'll talk with us about his book, The Power of Regret. Now, our next guest has devoted her career to understanding why mass shootings happen, how to keep them from happening, and how to react when they do. She's a former FBI agent who was chosen by the organization to create its active shooter program after the deadly mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. Police departments around the country have used her guidance in training programs, but sometimes those departments don't follow the recommended course of action. Police on the scene in Uvalde, Texas, waited 78 minutes to respond to the shooter in Robb Elementary School, raising questions about whether more lives could have been saved and why they didn't follow the protocol set by our guest of confronting the shooter as soon as possible. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been trained in your workplace, whether that's a school or otherwise, on what to do in the event of an active shooter attack? Is this something your children have trained on in school? What questions do you have about how law enforcement responds to these situations? And what do you think about how to prevent them in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Catherine Schweit is a former FBI special agent who retired in 2017 after 20 years. She created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She wrote the book Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really thrilled to be on Wisconsin Public Radio because Milwaukee was my first office as an FBI agent.
Really? Well, welcome back to Wisconsin via the internet. You wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about the ways that law enforcement in Uvalde apparently didn't follow the protocols for active shooter incidents. Can you tell us how they veered off course from what you might have hoped they would do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wrote this opinion piece with a little hesitation, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. No one wants to criticize law enforcement. And as a law enforcement officer for a long time, I certainly didn't want to. But I also felt it was my responsibility to speak up and say, hey, look, law enforcement all over the country has been trained since the Columbine High School shooting in 1999 to go directly to the shooter when an incident occurs, because the people, you know, who are out there, you know, with the shooter have no ability to protect themselves compared to a law enforcement officers who come upon the scene. But I think what we saw in Uvalde is that reasons that we really don't have all the reasons yet, but we will get, for some reasons, the law enforcement officers did not confront the shooter until more than an hour after they first engaged the shooter. And that was it's just unacceptable in terms of how we train law enforcement. And I've heard truthfully from law enforcement all over the country saying the same thing.
A couple of things that have come out with the interviews with law enforcement in Uvalde was, I think the person we all thought was in charge of the scene said he didn't think he was the commander on site. How important is it to just know who is in charge, who's making these decisions?
Oh, it's kind of law enforcement 101. You have to have somebody in charge. And generally the rule in law enforcement is the first guy on the scene or the first gal on the scene is the first one in charge. And in this case, it not only happened to be the first one on the scene, happened to be in charge, should have been in charge, but also happened to be the police chief for the very small department for the school police department, which has 6 people, not a very big department, but he was the police chief. He was first on scene with 2 local Uvalde police officers. And yet he did say in an interview that he felt like he wasn't in charge. And that's, from a law enforcement standpoint, a little incomprehensible, because that's exactly how you're trained. Incident command requires that whoever's on scene begin, take charge until the next person takes over.
Another point of concern, the judgment made apparently by the officers on the scene who were in the school at this point was that this was a barricaded suspect. The damage had already been done. There weren't lives to be saved anymore. And that apparently may have led to a lot of this delay. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I think this is where I'm going to go back to just with a little bit of caution to say, mm-hmm. Department of Justice is cops office is going to go ahead and give us a minute to minutes, maybe second by second incident report. That's going to help us to have a much better picture of who was where, when, and what they did. But with all of that caution, for our listeners to appreciate that I don't have all the answers. What we do know for sure is that the officers failed to plow through and find a way to get inside. And although they got into many other classrooms and helped other children and adults out of the building, you don't have a barricaded situation when you have shooting underway. And there was shooting underway, according to the chief and other witnesses, during that whole time, you know, off and on in that time period when they were stopped at the door and not moving through, looking for maybe better equipment to protect themselves or a key to get through the doorway. All of that is going to, I think, turn out to be incredibly unacceptable. And I do understand that sometimes law enforcement can say, oh, what's a barricade situation once we get to here? But the best information we have right now is that even once the officers stopped, they were fired upon, they didn't fire back, and then there was a time period, and then there were more rounds exchanged inside the classroom, and there was still no effort to move forward. Again, from a law enforcement perspective, that's just unacceptable, even though it's a very hard thing to ask a law enforcement officer to do.
Talking to former FBI Special Agent Catherine Schweit, author of the book Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kate, I want to zoom out from the particulars of the tragedy in Uvalde now. You are looking at all aspects of active shooting situations, and the best thing to do, it seems like, and you talk about this a lot, is prevent them from happening in the first place. What kind of things do we need to change, do you think, to make it so that we're not talking about police reactions, we're talking about not letting them happen at all?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right, Rob. You know, that's the situation, right? You know, when I put that book together, I found, as it turned out, that 10 of my 14 chapters were all about prevention, because prevention is the key here. And I think we have a very, as a whole, we're very unaware of how much control we have over prevention efforts. While people want to look at what happens during an incident, I think if we look at before, which is the prevention part, we should know, you should know that, you know, FBI research shows 68% of these people live with somebody, meaning that somebody is around them. You know, 44% of them are employed. So we know people are around them and who sees the things. And so part of it is who can see something and help prevent it. Almost everybody, certainly family and friends. But in the case of FBI research, 92% of schoolmates specifically had the shooters leaked information specifically to the schoolmates. And that 92% was shocking to me. Then I went on to read the rest of the FBI's report on who heard about something and didn't report it. And it turned out that 87% of the spouses and domestic partners, 75% of the teachers and school staff. So a lot of people are hearing and seeing things and not reporting it, but it may be because they don't recognize what to see. What are those warning signs they should be looking for? And those really have to do with somebody who's disgruntled or who has a perceived or real grievance. So they are leaking and they're frustrated. They're leaking information to other people. They're frustrated because they want to have a right wronged, whether or not they really truly were wronged. That's part of the grievance aspect. But then there are visual signs too. They might change their appearance. They'll give away their things. 30 to 40% of these individuals are on the road to commit suicide, and they want to do that whether they finish it or not. So they'll give away their things. They'll stop taking their medication. They change their appearance. And they leave signs. They write notes. They write in their notebooks in their bedrooms. They put up signs on their walls. They put a piece of paper on the refrigerator. And it may seem like, how could you not see that? But we often, everybody, we always kind of, we think the best about the people that we love and live around. And we don't want to ever think that they're going to be the ones who do that, which is frustrating, but true.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Oh, hi. I had sort of an idea that there's, in the past 20, 30 years, that there's been an increase in wealth disparity, and that in combination with easy access to guns. And your guest just commented on the suicidal aspect of it and the grievance. And I just thought that was an interesting correlation between wealth disparity and easy access to guns.
John, thanks for the call. Kate, what do you think?
I don't have any research on that, and I try to really work with numbers, but I think that the wealth disparity may also be reflective of frustration that we see in society. We know that the kinds of stressors that have to do with, the FBI's research on the shooters themselves, 49% of them were suffering with stressors that involve financial strains. So absolutely, wealth is part of the issue. Probably mental health, job-related issues, and pretty much conflicts with your friends or your family are the other high-level issues that cause a stress. But financial stressors are right up there. Half of the people the FBI studied fell into that category. So, John, maybe you're right. You're right on the mark there.
John, thanks for the call. Kate Schweit is with us, former FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She's talking to us about best practices for active shooter response, why they aren't always followed, and how to prevent active shooting situations from happening in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you want to see lawmakers change laws or policies related to mass shootings? What kind of trainings have you done in your own school, your own workplace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about active shooter prevention and response with Kate Schweit, a former FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi, I'm wondering if your guest thinks it might be a good idea that school employees could be trained and allowed to defend themselves and the students with small arms, and whether she thinks it's just a coincidence that these shooting incidents we seem to be concerned about all seem to occur in gun-free zones exclusively.
Jim, thanks for the call. You've looked at this issue, Kate, the idea of arming teachers and other school staff.
Yeah, Jim, thanks for the call, because I think that question, those questions come up quite a bit. And I think that one of the things I want to clarify is the idea that shootings occur in gun-free zones is a mistaken belief. So I just want, you know, the listeners to appreciate that the data doesn't support that. Certainly shootings occur in both gun-free and non-gun-free zones, or places where guns are taken all the time, but more of them occur in places where there isn't that type of prohibition. So that's the gun-free zone issue isn't really a discussion. And I say that I teach a class in the Second Amendment at DePaul University College of Law down in Chicago. I'm pretty familiar with the firearms and the gun regulations in and around the states. With regard to your first question, and I hear, I do hear several people often on say, should we arm teachers? Should we arm teachers? Would that be a safer way to do it? And I think here's the kind of the concerns that exist with regard to that, Jim, understanding that, you know, I was a law enforcement officer sworn for 20 years. I have a gun I carry. I know how to shoot. It's not about that. It's about the idea that almost every shooting in a middle school or a high school is a student at that school. A handful of them are students who have graduated. So what you're really asking a teacher to do is to raise a gun to one of their own students. And I think that many times, literally every teacher I've ever asked has said, I just can't do that. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some locations where a teacher might be able to do that. But when a teacher hesitates to fire, then the teacher's going to be killed because it's going to be gun against gun. And I also know that, you know, realistically, teachers get into that business to nurture. And so they're going to be inclined to see the best in their students and try to find a way to fix. So I think when we're looking, and I'm looking for big picture ways that we can solve this issue, for instance, in schools, and I mentioned before, in the school situation, there are twice as many of these types of shootings in businesses and places of business as there are in schools. So schools are about 20 to 25%, depending on what span of years you look at where these shootings occur. Those school shootings, that's a kind of a stretch, I think, to ask a teacher. And so to do that because of the emotional issues, but I'll give you this additional information, Jim. There are some states that allow that. There are some states that are doing that now. I think we don't have any data to see how they'll turn out. And I also, you know, as a person who carried a gun, also very concerned that you're bringing another gun into the scene. And when a teacher who is fired upon is killed, then there's another weapon with more ammunition in it picked up. And I've seen that occur. And also, you know, the things that other school people have been concerned about, which is, you know, can we get enough training for those teachers? Will the teachers be able to safely secure the weapon? So arming teachers is much more complicated, I think, than, you know, so I don't see that as the best solution forward, although I do believe that we need to kind of cobble our solutions together, Jim. So it's a good concept, but I think not something that we've seen a lot of success in the long run.
Thanks, Jim, for calling in, talking to former FBI Special Agent Kate Schweit, who created and ran the agency's active shooter program, author of the book Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. Back to your calls now. Donna is with us in Algoma. Donna, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment that I think that the gun regulations and law about the guns should be taken out of the Senate and Congress hands because they are so controlled by the NRA and the big money, and they do nothing anyways. I think it should be put to a vote for the public, to the public, and have it taken care of once and for all. And also, the teachers already are so full of responsibility, we don't need them to be armed and protecting our children. Donna, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Donna. There's not a referendum process to do what Donna wants. But Kate, are there, as you look in ways to prevent mass shootings, are there firearm related regulations that you think could make a difference?
Yeah, I'm no legislative expert, but I live outside of Washington, D.C., so I can pretend I'm one. Just kidding. There, you know, the concept, as you mentioned, you know, there really isn't a methodology to take that control away from Congress. That's the representative democracy that we have, is that Congress makes those decisions, and funds them. But in addition to that, right now, most all of the gun law that impacts every citizen out there is not federal gun law. It's really state gun laws. So I think one of the things that we may see and that might help is to have some federal legislation that really helps to kind of coalesce some of the laws that are supported around the country. One example of that is the proposal now for the red flag laws. There are currently 19 states and DC, District of Columbia, that have red flag laws that that's the nickname for them, but these extreme protection laws that would allow someone to go into a court and ask a judge to order that a gun be held from 6 months to a year, depending on the state law, or more. And that would be, if there was a move, that's one of the things that's in the Senate. That's one of the things that's in the Senate and House negotiations, is to enhance red flag laws around the country and support them by providing the financial support for them. What that would do, I think, is to help to coalesce what is the most popular, which I think is your point, Donna, is if you look at the research on, you know, what do the numbers show Americans believe in terms of background checks, universal background checks, or red flag laws, or raising the age to buy a semi-automatic to 21, you know, when you can't buy a handgun at 20 at 19, but you can get a semi-automatic, you know, that's kind of questionable for me, I think. So I wonder if we could pass some federal laws that might to help coalesce some of the laws that exist in the states that might help to, again, incrementally kind of control some of the concerns without taking away, without taking away the rights of people who are just abiding by the law, which is the majority of gun owners in the United States. But there's no question we have a lot of guns here, right? 400 million guns, 100 to 120 to every 100 people in the United States or something like that.
Donna, thanks for the call. We have just a couple minutes left, Kate, and I wanted to ask you about something else you've written about, how we train school staff and students to respond in this worst case situation where there is an active shooter. You're hoping to see some changes.
Absolutely. This is one of the things that I did, the reason I did write the op-ed piece in the New York Times. Back in 13 and 14, the federal government adopted the run, hide, fight as a national policy, just like stop, drop, and roll. That concept that, and I know from fact, from being at scenes and reading about and working on them, talking to law enforcement, that everybody at these scenes, when a shooting starts, they either run or hide or fight or some combination of that. But I'm very concerned and kind of frustrated that 10 years down the road, we're still primarily only teaching students the middle part, which is the hide part, which is lockdown. And I understand the concerns that schools have, but I'm hoping that parents and school districts over the summer will take the opportunity to reevaluate the ton of training that they give to the students and the faculty, because the faculty are the ones who are going to make the decision to run. And I can tell you that we know that, for instance, there were 9 children who survived when they ran out of Sandy Hook Elementary School in one of those classrooms that was being shot up. I know about children who jumped out windows at Virginia Tech and survived when their shooter was coming through the door. There are a lot of opportunities to run, but I don't think we teach our children to do that at any level. And the challenge to that is that we would run if we were in a movie theater or a mall or a park. But why do we leave our fate in the hands of somebody with a semi-automatic weapon who's coming through the door? I think I talk to my kids about that. I think parents should talk to their kids about that.
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Schweit is a former FBI special agent who retired in 2017 after 20 years. She created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She's the author of the book, Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. She talked to us about gaps sometimes in law enforcement training and school responses when it comes to mass shootings and some ideas on how to prevent them in the first place. Still time for you to share your thoughts and experiences maybe in these kinds of trainings. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest tackle kids, students' questions about fentanyl and how to avoid it and how to prevent it from circulating in their schools. Join the conversation. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30. That's here on the Ideas Network. Shiver me timbers and none of your beeswax. Those two statements came together in a new discovery of a lost treasure galleon on the coast of Oregon. That's Oregon the state, not Oregon, Wisconsin. Archaeologists discovered timbers from a Spanish galleon that was lost at sea in 1693. The ship carried silk and porcelain and blocks of beeswax, which is, I guess, pretty valuable then, too, to make candles. The timbers were found in a cave on the Pacific coast. Lots of galleons went back and forth across the Pacific. Many of them disappeared over the years, but only a few of these wrecks have been found. If you want to get rich quick, there's probably a better way than searching for lost treasure galleons in the Pacific. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.